Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interview and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
So whenever you're ready, just start us off.
Okay, so I will read the two poems that I chose. String Theory Relationships. The essential idea is this. The man you love is connected to you no matter what, but he's also connected to the woman down the street with the small dog that barks at the lilacs. And she's connected to the cashier at the market who's a bit rough with your grapes, but he thinks you're 10 years younger than you are and gives you free saltwater taffy while calling you darling. But he also calls her darling and her dog darling and the man you love along with the grapes. The essential idea is this. All objects are composed of vibrating anxieties. Everyone wants a window or an aisle seat, and no one wants to sit in the middle. Call it deniability. Call it the flashlight you keep by the door never works in emergencies. We are all connected by the blast that brought us here, the big bang, the slam dunk, the heavy petting. We can't always be pretty. We can't always be the eyelash and the wink. Sometimes we have to be the ear, sometimes the mouth. You are and are not the speaker in the story. You are the bridge connected to the land, connected to the man you love and the woman you dislike who teaches spin class. It's not personal. It's not personal when the universe says it's complicated and you have 10 minutes to understand quantum physics. When the man you love says there's a new connection called supersymmetry and it exists between two fundamentally different types of particles called bosons and fermions, you hear bosoms and females. You hear he's thinking about the spin teacher with the nice breasts and burrow deeper. The essential idea is this. Someone will always bruise your grapes and someone will end up in the middle. Someone you love will break your favorite coffee mug and bring you lilacs. And you will be connected to people who make your eyes roll. You will be connected to others who stand on the bridge and consider jumping off. You'll try to care for them. And you will not look your age, but you will feel sad when you look in the mirror because we all want to live a little longer. Because the dog will die and the cashier has lost his job for stealing saltwater taffy from the bin. But he still calls you darling, calls everyone darling. And today, darling, 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 the flashlight works. After discovering my husband bought a handgun, I said nothing. As you found a mistress and filled her with bullets, hid her in the laundry room when I came home. How could I know there was another? I was aimed at our future, an anniversary without bullet wounds. You are not the first man to believe betrayal is beautiful. You promised me nothing. Said gun was your new passport, your new itinerary. Said gun is the lock we never had on our doors. Said it's a dangerous world now. Gun will keep us safe. Said gun gives good dead. Gun to my head, gun in my bed. Gun lets you do things to her when she is loaded. Said gun is the lover you always wanted. It's always gun. It's always fun to have a new lover. So I slid my fingers around her neck and pulled hard.
Ah, Kelly Russell Agden. Hello, Poetry Salon listeners. I am Tricia Faye Hefner. With me is my fabulous co-host, Douglas Manuel. And today we are interviewing the poet Kelly Russell Agden. Kelly Russell Agden is a poet, writer, editor, book designer, and co-founder of Two Sylvias Press, living in the Seattle area. Her collection of poems, Hourglass Museum, was a finalist for the Washington State Book Award and was shortlisted for the Julie Suck Award, honoring the best book of poems published by a small press. She is also author of the best-selling The Daily Poet, Day by Day Prompts for Your Writing Practice, which she co-authored with Martha Silano. She was the winner of the Foreword Magazine's Book of the Year Award in Poetry, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, New England Review, and Oh, the Oprah Magazine. She is co-director of the Poets on the Coast, a writing retreat for women. Please welcome to the Poetry Salon cast, Kelly Russell Agden. Kelly, it's so awesome to see you here. And in some ways, I can't believe this is the first time that we're meeting. I've had you on my radar, and I think we've been friends on Facebook for about 800 years now. And I've always been aware of your work and what you were doing. But this is, I think, the first time we've actually been face to face in person. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This is your second collection of poems, Dialogues with a Rising Tide. I'd love to know a little bit about the genesis of this book.
The genesis of Dialogues with Rising Tides started back in 2014 when I was just kind of emotionally going through a rough spot. I just started writing poems and didn't stop. I was working at Two Sylvias Press, so a lot of these poems were written over like 6 years. And the manuscript was originally called Hesitation Waltz. And the poems all had a waltz to it. I had created a form. And then the world kind of changed, not for the best, in 2016. The stakes felt harder and higher, and my emotional state was not good. The environment was being put on the back burner, and I started writing environmental poems as well. So I kind of had two collections, but I thought, what if these two collections or these two manuscripts would come together, and what if they talked to each other? How would they inform each other? And what I kind of realized was there were two groups of poems, the poems about the broken world and the poems about the broken self. And I thought, for my own writing, it wouldn't be fair to just write about a broken world without acknowledging my own broken self.
Goodness, that's so beautiful. I love the idea of that. The whole time reading through this, what I thought about, I kept on thinking about the way I feel like guilt kind of underlines this whole one, being one of the themes, survivor's guilt, guilt of white privilege, but then also this total awareness. And I love it. And so kind of piggybacking off of that, I really want to start with that first poem, Hunger. And like, because I really like the idea of like just the first things that people decide to say to their readers. And for you, for this to be the first thing you want to say to me for your second book, just knocked me, I mean, to my knees. And so, you know, if we never have enough love, we have more than most. Oh my goodness. Could you talk about why that was the first thing that you wanted to say to your readers this time out? Could you talk about that, my dear friend?
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me because, as you know, the hardest poem is to decide, how do I shake hands with the reader? For me, that line, you know, reminds us through all the struggle, and a lot of the poems, when you're writing poems or when I can write a poem, I'm trying to tell myself something, and it's gratitude. You know, have gratitude, find gratitude. If we never have enough love, we have more than most, was kind of the handshake I wanted to give to the reader, and even invite the reader in with that love. You're going to go on a journey. There's going to be some tough times in this book. You know, I want you to know that we can get through this together.
It's really funny because, you know, my husband is culturally Jewish. And when we go to Passover, there's this phrase that I hear over and over that's like, if it had only been this, that would have been enough for us. If you had only freed us from Egypt, it would have been enough for us. If that line kind of reminded me of that feeling of like, hey, be grateful. It's not all going to be wine and roses, but you got to be grateful for what it is. You do have a little something, a little grain of hope, or a little hand to hold as we're about ready to head off on the journey into these difficult times. That's a great way of thinking of it.
Thank you.
It also makes me think, you know, like of like Chris Forehand's book years back, he had that quote from The Idiot from Dostoevsky of like, forgive us our happiness.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that book. I consider myself coming of age probably during the time period that you were writing this book. There's the things we can do. There's, it feels like the growing insurmountable level of things we can't do. And this book really said a lot of the things that I wanted to say. And so there was a lot of this that I felt like, damn it, she got there first. But also, no, she's also articulating what I've been struggling to say. So it's a measure of jealousy and gratitude at the same time. I don't know if there's a word for that.
Well, I actually, that's kind of the biggest compliment you can give to a poet, because I know if I tell a poet, I wish I wrote your poem. With jealousy, it reminded me of something I just heard lately, which is, so when you feel envious about something, what it means is it's kind of where you should aim yourself to hit your dreams. And that I thought was a really positive response to, if you feel envy, is like to then like recenter and say, oh, that's something I want. And if they can do it, I can too. But also in response to what you said about like, you know, writing it and articulating it and having the words, what I love is that there's always more words. Like you can write about these same topics so many times and come at them from different angles. And I know I've written about the same thing or the same in many different ways. And I've always loved how poets like Li Yang Li is someone who comes to mind, where you can say he is writing the same poem. It's the, you know, the earlier work, it's the Dead Brother in the Boots. But wow, that collection was one that really I responded to as a younger poet.
Yeah, and I think that is a good question that I'd like to know is, you know, who are some of your influences generally speaking, and who were some that you were reading? Because one of the things that strikes me about this book is it is universal, obviously, but it's also so very modern. It's specifically about these particular instances. You know, we all have anxiety, but only us living in this time period have that anxiety about being in the middle seat in the airplane. You know, it's so modern, but it's also so universal. So I'm curious who you were turning to or who you were reading as you were putting together this collection.
That is a really great question. I know Roger Reeves' King Me was one of my touchstones. No, I mean, I adore his work. I was reading Deborah Diggs, who died of suicide. And so I think for me, that was a poet to kind of get in touch with. And a friend and I were at a residency and we were looking her up, and we ended up watching what was the last reading she did before she committed suicide. I was thinking about her a lot since I was writing about suicide. Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton came to mind, but there's been so many other poets. And at the time when I was writing, Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, Kate Spade committed suicide, Chris Cornell. I mean, there's the list. and numerous other people who don't have celebrity status that we didn't hear about.
Since we're kind of moving to craft, I wanted to talk about, and this is something Roger does really well in King Me as well, but I was also thinking about Tarfia's work as well, like as far as titles, your titles, like Shut the Front Door. Like, so I wrote down like some of the ones that just really just hurt me. So Magpies recognize themselves in the mirror. I don't own anxiety, but I borrow it regularly. Everyone is acting as if we're not temporary, and I'm falling apart in the privacy of my own home. But yeah, so the whole point is I can keep on going, but like these long titles and these titles being poems in themselves and the kind of the first vehicles of meaning making that you give us, like, could you talk about that process? Like, do you do a first line and move up, or do you have a whole book of titles, like a whole file? Like, what's up? Talk to me.
Oh, I would love to talk about titles. And one of the reasons I do, and I really appreciate that compliment, is that titles have always been hard for me. And so they could be better because I have to really work at them. And I'm great at titling other people's work. I have friends that send me poems. We call them headless poems. They come in and I'll just respond and give them like seven titles. But when it comes to my own work, I'll look and I'll be like, what's this about? And a lot of times I do start out with the one line. The first line is the title. And then I tell myself, I went to a workshop and every poem you brought in had to have a title. And if it didn't have a title, you had to bring cake for the whole workshop. And so sometimes people would just stick a stupid title on the top of their poem, like morning or light. And when you came in and started your poem, the first response was, that's a cake title. Like, you just titled your poem so you didn't have to bring cake to the group. So when I do the one line thing, there's a little voice in my head that says, that's a cake title. And there are a few that will end up being the title, but a lot of them I think, you know, are you going to do the work? Are you going to really think about that poem, Facing It?
Yusuf, yeah, Kumanyika. Yes, that's so awesome,
yeah,
right?
The poem Facing It. So you read that title, and then you read the poem, and then you reread the title. And it's about the Vietnam Memorial. And wow, that title then has a whole other level. So when I'm doing my own poems, I try to hope that I put something up there that when you read it, then you can read it again. It does offer maybe another level.
Yeah, I want to probe that a little bit more. Most of the titles of my poems are cake titles. Just, I'm trying to think what is going to make this easy to find when I go into my files. And I'm just like, that poem about the bear. So it's just called That Poem About the Bear, or Bear Poem. Even when I read poems, I'll read the title and then something in my brain just goes, that doesn't matter, and turn it off and then read the poem. And then after I've read the poem, I'll usually go back to the title and be like, oh, no, that title does matter. Or did that title explain this? Because I didn't get the poem. And then I'll read the title of the poem and go like, oh, no, now I get more, you know. And so I'm wondering, do you... is titling usually the last thing that you think of, or how does that usually come about for you?
Sometimes it's the last thing, and sometimes I have a title and then I try to write the poem to go with the title, and that doesn't always work, but sometimes it happens. One, the poem about the bear, that could be a whole series, like the Friends episodes, the one about Ross's, you know, face pants, or that you could do a whole thing, the poem about the bear, the poem about the shoe. And here's a tip that happened when I was writing letters from the Emily Dickinson room, where all the titles are in alphabetical order. I would want a poem closer to the front. And so to do that, I would have to change the title of the poem, because, you know, if the poem was titled, you know, Return to Darkness, and it's way back there, I'd need to get it up. So it'd have to be like, oh, Another Light. So, but what I learned while doing that practice was the practice of changing, saying this title has to start with a M, gives your mind a constraint. when they're like, constraints sound like a bad thing, but they're actually great for a creative mind, because then your mind has to get around that. So if this poem has to be, you know, go between what's before L and N, you know, I need to come up with an M title. And so then you have this whole other constraint, which then will make you kind of go on to a whole different creative loop. So I noticed when I changed some of the titles, saying this title needs to start with D, the titles were actually better than the title I had given it, because I then almost lose that I'm writing, and then I'm into the play, almost like caring less about what I'm doing, and then something magical happens.
There is a great book called Free Play by Stephen Nachmanovich. He talks about how creativity works, and he's like, you know, you need to have constraints. It does it better. That sense of constraint really always, I think, almost always adds something. Yeah.
You can get your mind off the, sometimes writing a poem can feel very serious and, oh, this is an important topic. So if you give yourself these little rules to do, then it becomes more of a, you know, a play, like a Rubik's cube, or so. You have to work within these boundaries, and it can make you stretch yourselves in ways and do things that you wouldn't normally do. I sometimes think about, like, if I walk into a farmer's market and they're selling 20 types of jelly, I'm going to buy nothing, because I don't know, do I want the raspberry or the blackberry? Those are both really good. Oh, they have marionberry. Then I'm too overwhelmed, and I'm like, I
this
can't make
this talks to your first line too, and this idea of, seriously, it goes back to that, the burden of privilege. You would rather have the, like, it's almost, there's more freedom in the constraints, which is, of course, so paradoxical.
Gretchen Rubin has a book where she does, like, the four different types of personalities. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the upholder, they feel free because of restraints. The rebel does not.
Okay, this is just so funny, because I want to move into the four types of, what does Gretchen Rubin call it? It's the four tendencies.
Four tendencies.
Yeah, yeah. And so if you don't know it, Gretchen Rubin is a researcher. She lives in New York. She has a book called The Happiness Project, and I think their podcast is The Happiness Podcast, A Little Bit Happier. I'm so curious, are you, what did you say you were, the...
I'm an upholder with rebel tendencies.
your poems scream that. So hilarious. That's so true.
Yeah. Can you say a tiny bit about what the upholder is and how that fit into your writing?
Yes. The upholders don't need outside accountability. So I'm also a Capricorn. So playing into that, we get stuff done. I think for me, again, it kind of comes back to why I like constraints, is that too much freedom to me doesn't equal security. It equals, yeah. So even like, you know, like a safe household, or, you know, that your family locks the doors, when things feel chaotic, you know, that's not my happy place.
You were born in the wrong time, Ben. I'm sorry. Yeah, I feel like I don't want to, what do you call it, pigeonhole you based on, your astrological sign, but I can see everything is so well ordered, mm-hmm. And well, well constructed, and has such strong forms that if I believed in astrology 100%, I'd blame that on your being a Capricorn.
But Kelly, I want to go back to that idea of, like, kind of wisdom one from that kind of point of view, right? Because I think that idea, like when you talked about, like, kind of wanting the safety and kind of the security of form, and knowing the perils of chaos. So one of the things that the upholders have, I think, is this knowledge that there was never a safe spot, that we were never safe. Like, could you get to, like, how you landed there? Because I think that's something that so many people are wrestling with and trying to arrive at. And again, your book yells that piece of wisdom.
Oh, thank you so much. I don't know if I've ever felt safe. That's with parents who actually cared for me, and I had a great childhood and that, but I was born into this world with a strange fearfulness of people leaving me and of loss. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the poems in my book is called, "When My Therapist Tells Me My Father's Trauma Has Been Transferred to Me," yes. I think that's called imprinting, is that sometimes we come into the world with maybe a fear or something that isn't ours. And so as a sensitive person and someone who's highly empathetic to the world around her, my life is, I don't want to say elevated in the way of being better. I mean, elevated in the way where somebody can go through the day and not at one point say, oh my God, we all made it home alive. Where my mind can be right at the place of, no one died today. No one died today. What a good place to be. When my kid was not in college, there would be a point where, you know, it was like 10 at night. I knew my family was safe. My friends were okay. It was a pretty decent day, maybe not the best, but I could go to bed and just think, we're okay right now. That is something. And I do think it has to do, you know, my father, his first wife committed suicide and my grandfather did. This idea that people can kind of come and go. And my other grandfather died at 35. And my Nana would say, who's also in the book, because she went on hospice while I was writing this, would always say to me, sometimes you go to work and sometimes you don't come home, which probably is not the best thing to say to a small person who is very sensitive and very aware of people and the good and the bad in the world and who has it harder and that. And then to hear that on top of it, I'm like, I don't know how any of us make it.
Not to intervene. No, that totally did. But I mean, I vibe with that so hard. And I think even though that might feel a little trenchant, a little bitter, I think that realness is something that like so many people who wear privileged bodies need. My father once said to me, and it's in my book, in my first book, Testify, he said, save those tears, you'll need them later. And that too sounds like the most like horrible thing to say to somebody. But like, you know, sometimes you go to work and sometimes you don't come home. That's that real shit. That's that realness. Because like for so many other bodies, there's never been these safe spaces. And I think so many people are realizing, again, like your book is saying, my God, no one was ever safe.
And pay attention and be aware of it and, you know, try to take care of each other. Stand up when you can. So while you're feeling terrified, you also always have a voice. And if you are a white person, you can use that platform for good. So do it.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings, so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback, then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting for me, just speaking as someone who, you know, I am Caucasian, but I also did not grow up in a place like that I would consider to be a safe space. Kelly, bringing it to your poems though, I love to read with like a highlighter or take notes. And one of the lines that just slayed me was, yeah, I've seen the Grim Reaper wander my neighborhood in a Chanel suit with a diamond studded scythe, because we all want to be overdressed for the afterlife. We all want to believe there is a special place for us. And when I read that line, I was like, both this is so the book that I want to read. It says what I'm thinking, but also it says it from a totally different angle. I've been to those places where the Grim Reaper is walking around in a Chanel suit with a diamond studded scythe.
Oh, thank you. That was a harder poem to write, but it wasn't in a certain way where I think when I was writing it, that was actually when I was watching the death of my grandma, my Nana, really dealing with that. And that's the interesting part of social media is I was just a mess and I would go on and people are like, you know, here's my dog and here's my family and everyone's happy. And I'm like, don't you know, we're all going to die. And so it was an interesting poem to write. And I do feel it was one that just kind of, it came out really quickly, just kind of all together as a whole. And that surprises me when that happens.
Well, on that note of poems that are easy and difficult, I think now is the time to move into that segment. I would like to know a little bit generally about your writing process, and specifically, how did you come to write the one that you felt came easily?
So the one that I write poems easy when I write with friends. And I don't know if it's just, you know, you just want to entertain. So I want to write something a little more funny than if I'm sitting alone at my table. And so I do some writing with friends. And this was a prompt. Mary Pelin is Susan Rich's sister-in-law, and she had written a poem called String Theory. So Susan said, well, let's write a poem, kind of we'll read Mary's poem, and then we'll write our own String Theory poem. That poem I just started writing, and I thought, well, I've got to figure out what string theory is. And so I came up with that refrain, the essential idea is this. And we did have 10 minutes, which is why I said I had 10 minutes to understand quantum physics, because I'm like, how am I going to write this poem? I was an English major. So that one just kind of came out because it was play. It was fun. I was with a friend. And so my writing process is, when I'm with friends, I write really well. Or if I wake up in the morning and I write, I'll take notes. And if I have notes from the day, a lot of times the poems will come quicker. But I used to write from 7 to 11 or to like 2 in the morning. And now I realize I've switched and I'll write earlier.
And I have to tell you, I'm really upset that that was the easy one. You were reading that and, you know, it's beautiful and it's well-shaped, but it's like braiding and it all follows a pattern and it flows. And I said, if this is the easy one, I'm going to be so upset. And it was, and I am. So I just want you to know that.
But it goes back to restraint, right? Like you started off, Kelly, by talking about, you know, you got that restraint of that we're going to write about string theory. Like, you know, piggybacking, you know, remixing that other poem. So again, I just love how back to how everything is going together, that like this theme of that, like you are so emancipated from restraint.
Thank you. Yeah, the restraint does help. That's sometimes why doing a prompt where you have certain words to use can also, because I do feel like many times as a poet, I have this default vocabulary for a long time. Mm-hmm. Every poem of mine, what should I put in? Oh, a moth. Like, why are there so many moths in my poems? It's because that was the first thing. I'm like, oh, it's kind of dark and magical. And it goes. So sometimes I'll just make like a list of words. I go through other people's books and see what other words are people using. And I have a dictionary, you know, an old, it's not old, but it's a big fat paper dictionary right by my desk. And I'll pull it open and just choose words from it, because as a human, I have the words and the phrases and the way I do things. And so I like a little bit of what if I have to use these strange words? Like even lollygagging was a word I started using a lot. It's a common term, but it's in seven of my poems.
It sounds so good though. It sounds so good, right? The sound of that lollygagging. Come on.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll do the pivot to the difficult poem. I mean, of course, we got to hear it, but could you talk a little bit about the process of the poem that was the most difficult to write? That one, I believe, was boom, boom. Oh, the gun. I think I have a lot of ideas of why. Talk to us. And then especially thinking about, wow, this actually dovetails really well as well. Thinking about, you know, us talking about safety, us talking about us never being safe. I mean, I think maybe I threw you an alley-oop now.
So that one was hard for me to write for other reasons, because it dealt with my private life. And this was something that had happened. I was upset and angry, and I also didn't want anyone to know about it. I felt shame. I felt concern. I felt scared. This was another prompt that someone had said, well, write a poem where you're angry. Well, what's interesting is anger is not like my top. I will be angry at myself before I'm angry at anyone else. It's just, I don't have like that angry vibe. So writing this poem and actually sharing it was very hard. It did. It hit my own sense of safety, especially coming from a family where all of the suicides were done with guns. Mm. I don't want a gun in my home. And that was a really interesting time. It happened right after Trump was elected. My partner is not white. He worked for the Seattle Fire Department and had been on shifts where like a gun went shooting by. And so I was all about like, yes, get protected. But what I saw in him was a fear. So that I understood.
Wow.
Right. So heavy. That was the whole interesting part of it is I had that empathetic, I understand, but it was the lying for me. And that's what it's always been is I'm a really easygoing, open person. You just can't lie to me. Cause that also plays into my big fear of growing up in a family who kept secrets is that's not a security place for me. I feel very insecure and afraid when I'm being lied to. At that point, we had a teenager in the home and, you know, I know statistics. I'm not a fan of guns at all. When you write a poem, you do not have to share it with anyone. You can keep it in your files forever. And so when I was asked to write this poem, write an angry poem, I wrote it. And I thought, okay, I wrote it. Nobody ever has to see it. But in putting this collection together, I thought, I need to be authentic. I can't be the secret keeper anymore. I can't be the one who's saying, oh, my life's perfect, or everything's perfect, or there's these complex situations we come to. And having dealt with suicide in my book, I thought, this one's going to have to be in there and it's going to be harder for you. So it was hard in many levels.
God, thanks for giving that to the world. Thank you so much. Like, as somebody who writes in the post-confessional vein so often, like, the world's not owed that. No one's owed that. So for you to give that to us is so beautiful. I'm sorry I talked over you, Tricia, but like, I just always like to say that when people are that vulnerable and that personal, because, you know, like, I think when you write from that vein, people talk to you and talk about your work in a different kind of way, like they have something over you. So I just want to just say, just thank you so much for that vulnerability. That was beautiful. Thank you.
You know, it's funny because reading that poem, the only thing that was really on my mind was like how exciting that metaphor was. And how clever it was. And when I got to that line, the gun gives good dead. I think I finished reading the poem, but then I immediately went and emailed a friend of mine and was just like, oh my God, you have to read this poem. Look at this line. But I think that using that overarching metaphor, like the gun is a kind of mistress because it's something being kept. It's multi-layered, it's multifaceted. It sounds like you were able to have compassion and understanding for why your partner felt the need to do this, but it also is a very thought-provoking metaphor. I mean, any secret holder can be kind of like being cheated on with another woman. And then all the little ways you break it down was so interesting. You know, you can do things with her that you can't do with me. I was just like, it's so true.
And it's flipping the construct, right? Like a gun is always so phallic. And so just like with Queen Me in the text, like it's like this little like kind of moment of intervention. And then to reposition that in that domestic space like that, Queen Me too. Like, goodness, could you talk about that poem a little, Queen Me? I love that. I want to teach that poem forever. Like Queen Me, so, I mean, when he gets a queen says Queen Me too now, like that I love it.
I know which poem you're talking about. And if you're up for it, Kelly, could we actually, it's not a terribly long one. Could we ask you to read that one?
I would love to read it. Yes, that poem has to do with the language of the patriarchy. And it's very much of just, you know, you hear it all the time, the chairman, female athlete, just athlete. So that's kind of where it came from, you know, paying attention to, as we do as writers, to the language. Here it is. Queen Me. Playing chess, I realize how tired I am of the patriarchy, how the winning move involves the king, the useless piece, who can only skate square to square. When playing checkers, I taught my daughter to say as she slides her plastic red chip the full length of the board, "Queen me." It returns to my youth when I wanted to play baseball, but the coach said, "Girls can only play softball," and tossed me what looked like a small leather planet. "Queen me," I wanted to say when I couldn't be captain of the kickball team, couldn't play Santa in the school show. "Queen me," my daughter says to the neighbor boy, who without question places another checker on her piece. Later, I hear him say to my daughter, "Queen me," as they begin another game. "Queen me," he says again and again, as the universe begins to shift like a tilted tiara finally made right.
Yay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I remember reading that one too. And I'm a big fan of chess, although I haven't played it in years. And you're absolutely right. The queen does so much more than the king. The king is the most useless thing on that board.
Right. And it's the one you're protecting. And the queen's all over the board. Go diagonal. It can go straight. And the king's like, one step here, one step there. Protect me.
And then when you think how old the game is and couple that with that of just, you know, and they say there's no such thing as systemic sexism, you know, there's no such thing as systemic racism, you know, that's what they're saying right now, you know, like, Lord have mercy. Lord, that's amazing.
You know, I'm really fascinated about the construction of a book as a whole. I'm wondering, was there a point when you knew that this was a collection and you were getting it ready, were there any pieces you felt like needed more, or there were any pieces you had to write? As I noted, the last section, the book is divided into five sections. And I felt like the last section felt to me like those were the, for lack of a better word, the happy poems. And I'm wondering if those were intentional. Did you just collect all of those in one place to give us a little bit more of a happier way out?
Thank you. Yes, the section's called Relief, and all of the section heads are names of light ships or light vessels. And what those are ships that if there's a danger, like a rock out far, they become kind of lighthouses in the sea. And so I named each of the sections after them, like Shambles deals basically, if you read that section, it's all about America, which is kind of how I felt. And I wanted to end with Relief because similar to what Douglas said about opening the book with, we know if we never have enough love, we have more than most. I also wanted to kind of honor the reader and let them leave with from a place of hope. I didn't want someone to put this book down and say, "Thank you, Kelly. Now I need to go sleep for 5 days or walk into traffic." I always want to lead and leave with hope. I wanted to show that life is good and bad, light and dark. And I could put these poems, you know, sprinkle throughout to make sure that the reader's with me. But for this book, I really felt like I kind of wanted them towards the end to have kind of a lightness and to know that if they had any concern for the speaker of this book, that she's doing okay. Or I think for me, organizing a book of poems is the hardest part. So I'm glad that worked for you.
And while we still have you here, I just wondered if you would say a couple of words about To Sylvia's Press, which again is one of those things that has been sort of in the back of my mind. And I should tell you, full disclosure, one of my longest, long-term poetry friends is Kelly Crescio Moeller, whose book The Blue Shade of Trees you guys just published. So I think that's probably how I know, you know, one of the many, many connections I have with you. I was so delighted that Two Sylvias picked up that book. And I'm just wondering if you could say a few words about what it's like to run a press. Why did you do it? What is good about it? Should other people get involved with doing this?
just like I think there are never enough poets, I think that there are never enough poetry presses. You know, I have a, like, I don't have a scarcity mindset. I have much more of an abundance, which is just because there's more poets or more presses doesn't mean less for me. I always think that there's enough for everyone, that like the universe, we expand. The press was unintentional. We wanted to publish an ebook of women's poetry. It was 2009. My partner Annette had gotten a Kindle. I had an Apple iPad, and we wanted to read books, and there were nothing. So we created a woman's anthology called Fire on Her Tongue, and we wanted it to be an ebook. Well, poetry presses lag, so there was no press to publish an ebook, and nobody even knew how to do it. And if you put 3 line breaks in a row, it, because of the way the code was for ebooks, it would start a new page. So putting poetry, I don't know if you remember way back at ebooks, it was a mess. Like Whitman's, like he was one of the few that was all over the place. It was like zigzaggy. I'm like, I don't think Whitman really intended this poem to look like this dumpster fire on the page. So we decided, well, we have this, we'll, let's just start a press. We'll just publish it ourselves. And then a friend's book, her press closed, and she said, well, maybe you could reprint this for me. And we're like, we don't know how to do paper books. All right, we'll learn. And so that's how it began. And then it just kept growing. And what's lovely about Kelly's book, Kelly Crestio Moller, was we do a prize called the Wilder Prize, and it's for women over 50, because we were hearing from the community that there weren't a lot of, like, it's almost like, just like in Hollywood, at some point, women become the mother-in-law, and the male actor the same age is just dating someone in their 20s. We thought, well, maybe there is a need for this. And so every year we choose one book, and last year we couldn't decide. And so we chose 2. So that's another option, which we always allow ourselves. So that is To Sylvia's Press. We're just outside of Seattle. We are a small press. We do craft books. We have a poet tarot. And our mission is just, we believe good writing is great for the world.
I love that story, just getting called into it and saying yes, answering the call, and then just answering the next call and answering the next call. It's really lovely that you're doing it. Once again, that is Kelly with an I, Kelly Russell Agden. Her 2 books are Hourglass Museum from White Pine Press and Dialogues with a Rising Tide from Copper Canyon. She also has a book she co-edited with Martha Solano, Poet, Day by Day Prompts for Your Writing Practice. And she is one of the editors of To Sylvia Press. So check out all that Kelly Russell Agden is doing, and check out her work at www.agden.com. Kelly, again, thank you so much for being here.
Many thanks.
Kelly, thank you so much. And I hope to get to meet you in person in real life eventually.
Yeah, no, me too. I would love to, you know, gig up with you. We're up there, up in Seattle all the time, like doing stuff at the Hugo House and everything. So, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!